From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, some of the towers that make up the Department of Homeland Security's virtual border fence may be getting technological upgrades, Christopher Conover reports. Starting this fall, every child attending middle school in Arizona must receive a vaccination against meningitis. Kimberly Kraft tells us about a Tucson teacher who worked hard to put this policy into effect after suffering the loss of her teenage son. We'll hear about an Olympic athlete who lives and trains in Tucson, Jill Camarena, who will be representing the United States in the shot put event next month in Beijing. Tony Paniagua tells us her story. Bill Buckmaster interviews Dr. Victoria Mazes, the executive director of the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine. And Soo-Yun Lee profiles the work of performance artist Joanna Frew, a unique voice in the world of feminist art. That's all coming up on today's Arizona Spotlight. A stretch of border not far from Sasebo, Arizona, has become the test site for the Department of Homeland Security's virtual fence. It includes unmanned surveillance towers equipped with an array of technology, including radar and cameras that can distinguish people from cattle at a distance of 10 miles. Some of the towers along the virtual fence may also be getting an addition that some say will save lives. Christopher Conover reports.
Drive across the southern Arizona desert heading west, and you know it can be a lonely stretch with little or no cell phone service. Well, that may be about to change. The chairman of the Pima County Board of Supervisors, Richard Elias, says the county is requiring that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security put 911-only cell phone transmitters and receivers on any SBINet tower the federal government puts on county property.
And there's significant gaps in cell phone service throughout that region of southern Arizona. And the importance of having emergency services available to people who use cell phones solely as their means to communicate with people are very important.
The SBINet is also known as the virtual fence, and getting the 911 capability in remote parts of the desert is good for safety, according to Elias.
If we have people out there who are in trouble in the desert, whether they're undocumented crossers or whether they're folks who are out recreating, we need to have a way for them to be able to get help immediately, because we don't want to have people die in the desert. It costs us all money. It's a tragedy of huge proportions, and this is an opportunity for all of us to work together to achieve that.
The placement of the towers also has those who work with immigrants pleased. Reverend Robin Hoover with Humane Borders says there's a correlation between immigrant deaths and cell phone towers.
We created this scattergram that shows where the towers are and where the deaths are. And most of the deaths that occur in southern Arizona and southern California exist in places where there's no cell phone coverage.
Hoover also says the evidence suggests that many of the injured and sick illegal immigrants who do get rescued by the Border Patrol are picked up as a result of a cell phone call. And he says Mexican cell phones do work in southern Arizona and California.
We've tested that. We've actually gone over and bought cell phones and turned them on and walked in southern California on U.S. cell phone towers and all the way out into the Anza Borrego Desert. So we know that this is true. Humane Borders volunteers and I myself have found, you know, hundreds of cell phones that have been discarded. We've even found cell phones thrown down that the battery's still good in it. You know, it's on, so they were just there. Now, most people are not going to toss their cell phone. They're going to take it with them. So we are very aware of how much use there is.
Hoover, like others, points out that the emergency cell phone capability will help more than just illegal immigrants.
You know, if I drive west of Tucson, I find city, county, state, and federal employees all out there. We have land managers and home health nurses and all kinds of people, teachers and everything. So a lot of these people are commuting and on the road. This would be great coverage for them. The only thing that you will be able to call is to call 911 and to get an official that can patch you through to whichever agency that you need. So this is needs to be understood as a safety item, a public safety item, and not just for the migrant safety, though that's our primary goal.
Reverend Hoover has talked with other federal officials, including the Bureau of Land Management, about getting more cell phone equipment placed on the SBINet towers. And he says so far his reception has been positive, but other than Pima County, nobody has agreed to require the technology. Chairman Aliyah says so far the county hasn't heard back from the Department of Homeland Security about that requirement.
We have not heard back from them, but I fully expect them to agree to this because I think it's in their best interest. It costs us all money when people die out there in the desert, whether they're recreating or whether they're undocumented. We all spend money on that, and it's important that we provide a level of public safety to areas that have no cell phone service currently.
The Department of Homeland Security plans on constructing dozens of the towers covering the entire southern Arizona border. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
Thanks to a new Arizona law, public school students entering sixth grade this year must receive a vaccination against meningitis. A Tucson teacher and mother, Leslie Mayer, was instrumental in getting this new law passed. Mayer has been working to raise awareness of meningitis prevention since 2005, when she lost her son Christopher to the disease. Kimberly Kraft brings us the story.
Christopher Mayer planned to join thousands of new college freshmen entering the University of Arizona, and according to that plan, he would graduate in 2009 with a degree in business. None of that happened. On March 1, 2005, Mayer posed with his Sabino soccer team to commemorate their victory in the state championship.
I picked him up at 4 o'clock, and we talked about his future plans, and he seemed okay.
Yet only hours later, Christopher Mayer died after unsuccessful efforts to save his life.
Because within less than probably 18 hours, we went from having a healthy son to a son who was no longer alive.
Leslie Mayer says the team, including her son, had become run down following end-of-the-season tournaments and travel. She thought he had the flu and treated him with Tylenol and monitored his condition, ready to take him to urgent care if need be. The next morning, she left him in the care of her husband and went to work.
He ended up saying that they should probably go to urgent care, and when John went to check to see if he was ready to go, he was laying on his bed, and his last words were, "Dad, I can't feel my feet."
Paramedics took Christopher to the hospital, where he lost consciousness. By the time doctors could diagnose meningitis, it was too late to save his life. Nationwide, up to 3,000 cases of meningitis occur each year. 30% of those cases occur in the 15 to 24-year-old age group. The patients in this group have a much more deadly disease, and 20% of them will die regardless of the medications. Those who do survive may have brain damage, lose limbs, or suffer organ failure or hearing loss. Dr. Sean Elliott, professor of clinical pediatrics at the U of A, says while meningitis presents a threat to young people, the disease is preventable by eliminating risky behavior that transmits the bacteria.
It could be close contact by kissing, sharing a soda, sharing lipstick, sharing a straw, something fairly innocuous, but still has potential to transfer the organism from mouth to mouth and from airway to airway. It's incredibly frustrating to healthcare providers because, again, by the time we get these patients, 9 times out of 10, it's too late. And there will be heroic measures administered, antibiotics, blood pressure support, cardiac resuscitation, and it is just a losing battle.
Students should get plenty of rest and drink lots of water. They should also practice good hand hygiene.
By that I mean washing hands before and after the restroom, before and after meals, before and after going to a party, before and after classes, you name it, washing hands.
Though the University of Arizona stops short of mandating immunization for entering freshmen, many universities have adopted that policy. Nancy Mayer learned about the vaccine approved in February 2005. 1 month before the death of her son. She says nothing will bring her son back, but as a teacher, she knew she needed to teach people about the disease to prevent more children from dying.
And I had promised my children in my kindergarten class, when I went back to teach, the first thing I told them was, through my tears, I said, you know, I'm going to do all I can to keep you from getting this disease.
Mayer says though Christopher had a short life, he made the most of each day, something parents should always remember.
I would like parents to remember to don't sweat the small things with your kids. I would like parents to remember that, you know, your kids are only with you for a short period of time, and they, even if they're just going to leave home, you want to make the most of each moment that you have with them.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Kimberly Kraft.
Kids can receive free immunizations today and tomorrow at a safety fair for children called the Care Fair. The hours are today from 9 until 7 tonight and Saturday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Sunnyside High School, located at 1725 East Bilby Way. Also, the Pima County Health Department is holding free immunization clinics at the Tucson Convention Center throughout the month of August. We have a link to the complete schedule online at KUAZ.org. And we'll have more Arizona Spotlight coming up right after this break. Years of training and hard work have made a dream come true for Jill Camarena. She's representing the U.S. next month at the 2008 Olympic Games in Beijing. Her sport is the shot put, a track and field event that doesn't often get much time in the spotlight. As one of three women on the team, Jill had to outperform over 20 other Olympic hopefuls to earn her place. And this was after she suffered a setback that almost ended her athletic career. Next, Tony Paniagua tells us Jill's story.
Jill Camarena has been training diligently every week under hot, humid conditions and all other types of weather, hoping to make it to the Olympics someday. And after more than a decade of dedication, practice, and perseverance, she's turning her dream into reality.
I gotta go.
Camarena has been shot putting since she was 12. She's now 26 and one of only three women who made it to the U.S. Olympic team.
It's something I've always wanted, so it was just so exciting to be there and have my family there, and it's been kind of a crazy year, so to actually still make the team is amazing.
You were telling me you had back surgery?
I did. I had back surgery in April, beginning of April, so just been rehabbing and trying to come back from that, so luckily I did, and I get to go to Beijing.
Camarena is originally from California, but she moved to Tucson a year and a half ago so she could train with Craig Carter.
It means a lot that she's made the team and that I'm part of that.
Carter had been working with Camarena in Utah, but when he got a job at the University of Arizona, Camarena followed him here.
Yeah, she was getting her master's degree at BYU, and when I got the job, and you know, we weren't sure what she was going to do, and she said, "Well, I'm moving to Tucson with you." So she packed up, moved here, and kind of showed her commitment to me and then to the sport and trying to make the Olympic team.
But Camarena wasn't even sure if she would make it because she had to be operated earlier this year.
A lot of people that have had back surgery said, you know, you might not make it, and I was devastated, but, you know, talking to the surgeon, he said 6 weeks and then you're going to have a month of hard training. I was like, all right, we're going to give it a go. So I just had to try. I mean, if you work that hard for something, then you just can't give it up.
So she keeps a grueling schedule that requires constant training, including weightlifting and running.
In my opinion, it takes a great athlete, first of all. And a great athlete, you know, is someone that has, in my opinion, has good strength, good balance, good speed, good explosive power. And that, in any sport, if you have those qualities, you're probably going to be a pretty good athlete, no matter what sport you play.
You also need other qualities like patience, balance, and precision.
Definitely takes a lot of patience. I mean, you do the same movement and yet every time you're probably doing something wrong, you know, different though. But so it's a lot of patience and a lot of time just, you know, between throws, thinking about throws, film analysis, things like that. Just really, you know, just trying to perfect something that will never be perfect no matter how hard you try. So it's a lot of frustration, but it's, you know, when it does go well, it's great feeling.
It's tough work, but she's optimistic about the U.S. track and field team.
They're going to do great. We have a really good team this year. I mean, lots of people have run, you know, the fastest times in the world or jumped the furthest in the world. So I think we're going to do really well in Beijing.
It was a dream of mine to go to the Olympics and as an athlete, and that, you know, that didn't happen for me. But the fact that I get to experience that as a coach is, it's always been a dream, you know, and I've always wanted to go to the Olympics, and now I finally get a chance to go.
But first, there will be plenty of additional practices and training. Camarena departs for China at the end of the month, and Carter will join her later. Their unforgettable day is August 16th, when all of their years of commitment and concentration will be put to the test in front of the world. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Tony Paniagua.
The University of Arizona's Center for Integrative Medicine was founded in 1994 by Dr. Andrew Weil, designed as a place where medicine was focused on healing instead of on disease. This month, the Arizona Board of Regents has awarded the Center for Integrative Medicine Center of Excellence status. We'll learn more next from Bill Buckmaster in this interview with the center's executive director, Dr. Victoria Mazes, who is also an associate professor of medicine, family, and public health at the University of Arizona.
Dr. Mazes, good to see you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
How big a deal is this? Why is this important?
Well, this is a real recognition at the University of Arizona, at the College of Medicine, of our accomplishments to date.
It's always nice to be recognized by your peers, isn't it?
Yes, it's wonderful.
Does this help in recruiting faculty into the program?
Absolutely. It helps in many ways. We are at present expanding, and so we are looking to recruit a new research director. We have a goal of recruiting someone who will help us with our environmental medicine initiatives. Over time, we would like to recruit an integrative oncologist, and we're confident that the Center of Excellence status will certainly help us with that.
Before we go any further, and I know there are some very impressive numbers about the program since this began in 1994, but define for us how you accept the term integrative medicine.
Of course. Well, integrative medicine is healing-oriented medicine, and so we really look at that paradigm of the body's natural ability to heal and what can we do to facilitate that. It brings the best of the doctor-patient relationship into bear. We get to know our patients by asking a different set of questions, really trying to understand their story. And then we bring together the best from conventional medicine. We don't disregard what conventional medicine has to offer, but also what can we learn from botanicals, from traditional Chinese medicine, from healthy nutrition? What can we do with those lifestyle aspects as we look at a whole person, body, mind, and spirit?
And the program really has pioneered in many areas, and I was mentioning a few moments ago about some impressive numbers. You've had many fellows that have come through. Kind of characterize for us the since you began, because you've been with the program, I believe, since the beginning. How has it been?
Well, we've grown tremendously over the 10 years that I have been now at the center. We began really just with a residential fellowship in which we trained four physicians a year. It was an immersion program. You came for 2 years and studied integrative medicine. Now we have a whole range of fellowship programs. We train 80 physicians a year in our distance learning fellowship. We have 450 doctors, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants who we've had enroll to date. Many of them are leading programs at other universities all over the world, actually, but at leading universities around the United States, starting their own programs. We have initiatives where we do collaborative work in family medicine, in rheumatology. We're beginning one in oncology. So it has grown tremendously. As well, we do clinical care and research.
And to change perceptions that many general practitioners have of integrative medicine, maybe some would be hesitant to accept it, but is that changing, those attitudes?
Yes, that's changed tremendously. In the 10 years that I've been here at the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, we've seen the development of integrative medicine at academic health centers all over the country. In fact, the University of Arizona co-founded the Consortium of Academic Health Centers for Integrative Medicine. There are now 46 members around the United States and Canada. And to be a member, you need dean-level support. You need an active program in integrative medicine, including education, clinical work, research. So it's not just wannabe, it's actually having a program. And Harvard's a member, Stanford, UCSF, UCLA, Duke, many very reputable institutions.
Right. So young doctors are learning about integrative medicine, it's safe to say.
Yes, and I think that's one of the most exciting things. Just last week, we began our Integrative Medicine in Residency initiative. This is a collaborative program with 8 residencies around the United States. The residents will have 250 hours of required curriculum in integrative medicine, and it's all the residents. It's no longer a track. We hope to take this program to more residencies and eventually get it into all residencies. Our goal is big.
Talk a little bit about the diet. I know you're, in doing my homework for this interview, I believe you like that Mediterranean diet.
Yes.
What do you like about it, and what specifically is a Mediterranean diet?
Well, the Mediterranean diet, I think, has been proven to be one of the healthiest diets in the world. It comes from the Mediterranean region, and it includes lots of legumes, lots of whole grains, lots of vegetables, some fruit, some dairy, although mostly in the form of yogurt and cheeses. It also includes some alcohol. And people who follow this Mediterranean diet have less cardiovascular disease, less cancer, and in fact live longer than other people. And it's been adapted and studied in this country and also in several countries around Europe.
So when you're doing that piece of salmon on the grill,
yes.
Put some extra olive oil on there,
That's right. Olive oil
is
the healthy oil that we all want to be used. It's full of monounsaturated fat, which is the healthiest type of fat. And that was one of the key features of the Mediterranean diet that has really been proven to be so beneficial to health.
We only have a few seconds left, but we hear exercise, exercise, exercise. Is it cumulative during the week, and is walking count?
Walking definitely counts, and I'd say it's cumulative during the day.
Okay.
You want to do some form of physical activity every day. It doesn't have to be in a 45-minute single burst, but over the course of the day, if you could get in between 30 and 60 minutes, you're going to be doing your health a big favor.
I could do that just walking here up the stairs from the basement to the first floor instead of taking the elevator,
you
right?
You could, or get out your pedometer and measure 10,000 steps.
I've got that pedometer at home. Thank you very much, Dr. Mays. It's good to see you. Congratulations on the Center of Excellence.
Thank you so much for having me.
Artist Joanna Frew has been writing and performing her work for 25 years. She's been described as a wildly original voice in feminist art. Her writing often celebrates her vision of beauty, sensuality, and eroticism. You'll hear some of Joanna's poetry next as she describes what drives the creation of her work in a profile produced by Soo-Yun Lee.
When did I know I am goddess of roses? When I see Aphrodite crowned in white rose petals, they are a thicket of white. They are her hair itself, styled in the name of love. When did I know I'm goddess of roses? When I see any sister goddess plaited in pearls.
For me, feminism is about freedom for everyone, and my work has a lot to do with that. I'm Joanna Frew, and I'm a performance artist. Writing is the foundation of all my performance work, and I've also taught as a professor of art history.
I am the pinks grown so at home with their own beauty that they are not impatient for your love. Pink. I am bountiful and not complacent.
The history of performance art is generally dated to the beginning of the 20th century with the early 20th century art movements. Dada, Futurism, etc., all had their performance aspects to them. And these days, performance can be, this is always the killer when you say this too, especially lay public. It's like, oh, it can be anything. I could get up and walk out the door and then close the door. That's it. I could get up and I could walk out the door and slam the door. Or I could pick up one of those flowers over there and rip the petal off. And that's performance. There are many different ways of doing performance. And so I do a kind of performance. Obviously, it is text-based. It's all my writing. I speak the work. Mine is not a radical kind of work in that kind of theater setup. Its radicality comes in its content, in its subject matter, in its honesty, in its sometimes sexual or erotic explicitness. My mother would say about my work, she read my first book called Erotic Faculties, and she loved it, and she read it again, and she was in her 80s at that time. And so she said, you know, you say things that everybody thinks and no one says.
How many times has Goddess of Roses heard or read the following statement? I'm terrified of getting old. Sometimes, like everyone, precedes it. When Goddess of Roses hears or reads that statement, she has recognized various feelings. She has felt a pall surround her. She has felt queasy. She has felt repulsed. Words are food, and she has felt sickened. Words can lodge in the abdomen, in through the ears and down the digestive tract of consciousness.
I talk about love and human relationships, and I do deal a great deal with the erotic.
Our culture equates erotic with sexual activity. That is simplistic. If we let it, the erotic, which is connection, can permeate our lives. The rose is a symbol of that connection, of sacred and profane love.
The erotic is a connection when I'm having my tea in the morning and I have the back doors open and I hear the birds. That is erotic because that's connection. I have critiqued beauty culture.
Whatever is common to people or typical of them, we call human. However, the typical or common is not necessarily the essential, though they may appear to be. The typical or common may become so through social or historical patterns, such as ethnic hatreds that breed wars, physical abuse that repeats through generations of a family, and women's repulsion by their own bodies in the late 20th and early 21st centuries because of increasing media focus on the generic ideal of tall, slim, blonde, and big-breasted. The human seems so, seems real, because we've known it for millennia or decades.
Now, as I critique that, I'm presenting other ways of thinking, other ways of looking, other ways of being.
Goddess of Roses has let down her guard.
I want them to come away with loving self-acceptance of themselves, of their beauty, of their bodies, of their ability to be loving and to be compassionate and to be fully, fully human.
You were afraid that she'd be full of frowns. She's a gentle fountain.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media, and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. Most of the music heard on our program, including the theme, was written and performed by Calexico. Podcasts of Arizona Spotlight are available online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.